street.
I'm Doug. I'm a heroin addict. Trying to figure out where to put this thing. Right here. All right. Congratulations. Is it Luke?
Yeah.
That's cool.
Thank you.
Thank you. And Ian, congrats again. I seem to come up here and celebrate my birthday with you guys every year. I spoke here for my 32nd birthday last year, and so I get to celebrate my birthday with my good friend Ian, which is cool, and now my new friend Luke. And that's the one thing I really love about this fellowship is that there are no strangers in Heroin Anonymous. There's just friends you haven't met yet. And, you know, obviously I got sober when I was a fetus. Yeah, I'll be 60 years old next year, and I got sober when I was 26. And, you know, and they had heroin back then. Jimmy and I were talking about the good old days. Before fentanyl and all the shit that's absolutely tearing this world apart, you know. And it was different back then because today, most of the people who are heroin addicts got there on the road from opioids. And back when I got sober, there really wasn't, I mean, yeah, they had Percocets and things like that, but there really wasn't the same pathway. You know, you just started shooting heroin, you know. But I didn't always do heroin. No, there was a time when I was a little boy, and I had a nice family, New England family. My parents are still alive and still married. Been married 63 years, I think it is. They met when my father was 15 and my mother was 13. And they've never been with any other person in their life. They've just been since they were little kids, you know. And it's kind of romantic in a way. I don't get it because I was kind of a slut when I was out there. I just, you know, that's not my truth. You know, and in 1957, my sister was born. And in 1959, I don't think I was born. I think I was more like spawned because, excuse me. You know, I was born into this family that was beautiful. And, you know, my parents, loving, tender, supportive. You know, when I got to the program, first of all, there was no HA when I got here. And so I was going to AA and I was going to CA. And I didn't hear my story for a long time. I heard stories of broken homes and drug-addicted parents and abuse. And I thought, man, this is the last house on the block, and I don't even belong here. And the old-timers would come, and they'd put their arm around me, and they'd say, just listen, just stay and just listen. And eventually I did hear my story. And then I heard it over, and I heard it over and over again. And then I came to terms with the fact that it wasn't really about where you came from, and it wasn't about whether your family or your parents were addicts or your parents were abusive or any of that. That didn't make me an addict. You know, what made me an addict is that when I started using, I couldn't stop. And the problem was is that when I wasn't using, I had to start. Can anybody relate to the notion of, like, I am not going to use today no matter what, and then that thought hits? I call it the thought crime, and then there's nothing to stop you from getting loaded. The Big Book uses fancy words. They call it a mental obsession, you know. I call it I'm fucked. Yeah. My friend Steve and I were like, we're done. We're not going to do dope anymore. He's lying on his bed. I'm lying on the couch. And all it took was a look. All it took was the look. I'd look at him and he'd look at me. And then one of us, we were in Queens. We were in Astoria. And we'd go, downtown? And that was the code. That was the code word. And next thing you know, we're in a cab, we're heading downtown, cop some dope. And, you know, but it took, you know, that was nearing the end. And there was more to the story that happened before that. You know, there was a story about, like, when I was in elementary school and the cop who came to my school, probably the same cop who went to your school, and told you about the perils of drugs and alcohol. Do you have that cop who go to your school? Some of you had DARE, right? Yeah. Oh, thanks. Yeah, I was pre-DARE. We had a cop, and he put on that movie Reefer Madness. Bunch of people smoking pot and getting crazy and having sex. And I was like, that's a deterrent? Yeah. But I did actually believe him, and I believed that drugs were dangerous, and I was scared of them. But as I started to progress and try different drugs, you know, the kind of this lurking notion was in my head that, you know, if I do this cocaine, that I'm going to be selling my body down on the street corner for more cocaine. And if I do this heroin, you know, I'll end up a junkie on the streets and, you know, a convict and all that stuff. And, you know, none of that happened until later. And, you know, so as I was doing the drugs, and, you know, he was wrong. He was wrong. You know, and I went to high school, and I went to high school in England, and I was in the 70s, and the 70s were apparently quite great. And I say apparently because I don't really remember the 70s. I remember some things, like going to see the Clash or seeing the Sex Pistols in little pubs the size of this room, and we didn't realize that what we were seeing was a revolution in music. And everybody was loaded. You know, we're in restaurants and doing lines on the tables and smoking joints in public, and you know, it just seemed like there was a lot of people turning their head the other way. And in the pubs in London, even if you were underage, they didn't card you back then. They just serve you beer. And it was, I thought it was great. I thought it was a great time. And, you know, and then I moved to New York, and I went to upstate New York, and I went to college. And I don't remember college. I found non-addictive heroin in college. Any of you guys do heroin here? I'm just checking. I want to make sure I was in the right room. And it wasn't addicting. Heroin was not addicting. We were snorting it, right? Every 2 weeks, somebody would go down to the Big Apple, to New York City, buy a bunch of bundles of dope, come back to our school, which was about 100 miles away, and we'd all do dope, puke, have a great time, and nobody got addicted. So I didn't get it. It didn't dawn on me that we were counting the minutes, counting the seconds for the next time somebody would go down to New York. I remember one time it was my turn to drive down, and it started to rain. My windshield wipers didn't work. That didn't deter us. We tied a rope to the windshield wipers, and my friend is doing this with the windshield wipers for 2 hours. Yeah. But we're going to get our dope. And, you know, and then I got out of college. I think I actually graduated. I have a diploma. It's like watching an old-fashioned slideshow, and 9 out of 10 slides are missing. That's what my memory of college is like. And I moved to New York City. I started driving a yellow cab in New York. And heroin driving a cab is a really bad mixture, you know, because you tend to nod out. And if you're going down First Avenue at 50 miles an hour with a fare in the back and you nod out, it's just not good. But I did it, and then I broke into the film industry. And at this time, I didn't consider myself having a problem. I just liked heroin. I'd never experienced dope sick yet. But I was doing heroin every day because I liked it. That was the delusion that I had. Delusion means lie to self. And when you lie to yourself, you don't know you're lying to yourself, because you're lying to yourself. I'm the last one who knows that I'm deluded. You know, so I'm, you know, I didn't think it was a problem, and I'm still managing. I'm making money driving a cab, and then I my career path was to work in the film industry, and I got work after a couple of years in the film industry, and I started making a lot of money. And in the Big Book of Alcoholics Anonymous, there's a chapter called Bill's Story. And in Bill's Story, Bill is one of the founders of AA. And in Bill's Story, he talks about making money on Wall Street and playing golf, and he says, I had arrived. And that was my moment in my story where I had arrived. I was making money, I was producing music videos. This is right in the very beginning of music videos. And I was working with some famous people, and you know, I had money coming out of my ears, and it lasted about 3 months. And they kind of frown on you when you leave the set for like 4 hours. And I would leave the set in the middle of the day because I started feeling funny. And the message I got was, a little heroin would fix this. I didn't know that I was getting sick. So I would leave the set in the middle of the day, and I'd be gone for hours. Well, in the industry I was in, it was a freelance industry, so you're only as good as your last job. So they stopped calling me, and I started falling down the list, the call list. I went from first call to substitute to if you're desperate to don't call. And before you know it, I'm out of work. And I started that funny feeling that I would have that would tell me that I would need heroin got worse. And now, anybody kick cold here? Yeah, it sucks. And, you know, I'd start to get these feelings like muscles tightening up my neck. And, I mean, it would just start straining, and I'd start getting nauseous, and I'd sweat, and yet I was freezing. And I didn't know what the hell was going on, but the heroin had fixed it. That's great, but I didn't have any money. So I did what any smart heroin addict would do. I started to steal. So I went from making buku bucks, you know, buying a bundle a day, to just being a common thief in just a few months. And, yeah, I didn't know what to do. Now I knew I had this habit, and I knew what dope sick looked like, and, you know, and somebody said, you know, the junkies go, and I wasn't a junkie. No, they lived on the street. The junkies would go to the methadone clinic, and when they'd get their methadone, they'd come out and they would sell it. Mm-hmm. And then so you could buy methadone and kick dope on your own. You don't have to join the clinic. I was like, oh, that's good. Last thing I want to do is be one of those guys who's on the methadone clinic. And so I remember every few days I would buy an 80-milligram bottle of methadone. And really, it was kind of this back-and-forth thing. I would do 3 days on methadone, and then I feel like I got it. I've kicked it. It's gone. And then after about a day, when the methadone would start to wear off, then I'd go and buy some heroin. And after about 3 or 4 days on the heroin, I go, fuck this. I'm back to where I was. And so I go back down to the methadone clinic and buy 80 milligrams of methadone. And this went back and forth, back and forth, back and forth for a while. Now, my parents had no idea that I was unemployed. They had no idea that I was living this way. They had no idea that I had a habit. And my father, who had traveled most of his working life, I had all these miles saved up through the airlines, and he contacted my sister and I and said, let's go back to London for a New Year's reunion. Now, this is New Year's 1984. New Year's Day would have been 85. So I thought, that's going to be a perfect opportunity to kick dope. So I got 80 milligrams of methadone, went down to JFK, drank the methadone, got on the red eye to London, the overnight flight, was fine going over there. I was going to stay with some friends of mine that I had known years prior from high school. And I went to their house, and it was the morning. And the guy had some crackers, he had some cheddar cheese, he had some smoked fish, like whitefish, and salmon. And the fish had gone bad, and I didn't know that. So I ate this fish, and then the next morning I go to my parents' hotel to have breakfast with them. And in the middle of breakfast, I get food poisoning. And also in the middle of breakfast, I start to kick. So I'm going in full-blown detox and food poisoning at the same time. And my father, he just thought I was sick, and he gave me the key to his room, and he said, go lay down. And I didn't leave their room for 3 days. And, you know, I ordered room service, and I ordered a glass of milk, because I wanted to coat my stomach. I ordered a glass of vinegar, because somebody in New York told me if I drank vinegar, it would remove the toxins from my body quicker. I'm still looking for that fucker. And then I ordered a bottle of Jack Daniels, you know, to forget the whole thing. And, you know, I drank the milk, drank the vinegar, drank the Jack Daniels. Jack Daniels didn't get me drunk. I couldn't drink this thing away. And it was New Year's Eve, and this desperate, desperate soul just kicking dope cold in this hotel room. And, you know, I have the garbage can next to the bed, because I'm just puking like crazy, and just stuff coming out of all openings in my body. I wasn't a vision for you, that's for sure. And I remember there was this movie, there was this old English movie about a candy factory. And it may not have been about a candy factory, but I remember this one scene in this candy factory. And there was a conveyor belt, and it looked like a tongue. And there was this machine that looked like a mouth with big eyes. And it was belching candy out. It was going, burr, 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 bleh. And then a piece of candy would go down the conveyor belt. And I'm watching this thing, like watching a bad accident. And, you know, every time it would go, bleh, I'd be like, whoa. And it's funny the things we remember. You know, I don't remember a lot more of that night. I do remember trying to kill myself twice. The first time I was going to jump out the window, but the windows don't open, so I threw a chair at the window, and the chair just bounced off the window. And then I got a really brilliant idea. I thought what I would do is I would it was a semi-suite sort of thing. It had a bed, it had a couch, and it had a big heavy coffee table with sharp corners. It was made of stone. And the chest of drawers was really low. There were only about three drawers, and they were about 3 feet off the ground. So I thought, perfect idea. I'm going to move the chest of drawers right in front of the coffee table. I'm going to get up top of the coffee table. I'm going to dive headfirst into the corner of the coffee table. It'll split my head. I'll die instantly, and it'll look like an accident. Because I didn't want my parents to suffer, you know. So I wanted, you know, oh, my son died of a junkie. No, he died of an accident. Well, that's good, you know. So I get up on the bureau, and I'm like, you know, I got my hands behind my back, and I'm just kind of eyeing it, you know, getting the target lined up, and I don't want to watch this thing. So I close my eyes, leap forward, miss the coffee table, and it was like this high pile, what do they call that, shag carpeting, right? And I'm just like, ping, 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 and I get rug burns across my chest, and my nose is bleeding. And it was one of those moments where you're lying there. You remember the moments where you don't know whether to laugh or cry? You know? And I started to cry, and then I just started to laugh hysterically because I knew, what a sight. You know? What a fucking sight. And I don't know how long I laid there, and time, when you're kicking, time just goes in and out. Things are wobbling around. But I do know it was the third morning. And the third morning was almost like somebody came up to a pitch black room and peeled back the curtain just a little bit. So just a sliver of light came in. And that sliver of light was a sliver of, not hope, well, yeah, kind of hope, but it was more like a sliver of feeling just a little bit better. Just like not quite as nauseous, not quite as the muscles weren't quite twisting as much. And I was like, okay, maybe this thing is going to end. Maybe I made it. And I remember I turned on the shower as hot as I could take it, and I laid down on the floor of the shower, and I let the water just beat on me. Just like, I felt like it was kind of rinsing this thing out of me. And I said a prayer. And it was one of those foxhole prayers. It was, God, if you get me out of this one, I will never do heroin again. And I'm an atheist, you know. So, but, you know, everybody becomes spiritual when they're desperate enough. And, we went on with the trip. And when I got back to New York, I borrowed my mother's car. And I drove to the Lower East Side of New York. And I found non-addictive crack cocaine. It was one of those moments where a friend of mine, this Puerto Rican kid named Jay, he had this glass contraption, and it had all these kind of, like, it was a contraption, right? And he pulls out this propane torch. I was waiting for the mask to come down. And he lights it up, and he starts heating up this thing. I'm like, what are you doing? And he started sucking in this through this tube, and his eyes rolled back in his head, and he said, and I have resolved, I am not going to do this. I have no way. And Jay said, would you like it? And I said, yes, I would. Will you teach me how? And, you know, crack cocaine is not terribly addicting. I think it took 8 seconds. And, you know, I know we're in an HA meeting, but it's part of my story. And crack cocaine is like having sex with a gorilla, because you're not done until the gorilla is done. And it just boom, 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 boom. And, that's my CA. That, this part here is like CA story, okay? And, you know, wearing a wetsuit in Times Square, just lots of weird shit. Because when you do heroin, you know, crack cocaine, manic. And, you know, I was a one-man freak show on that stuff. And you know, I cleaned ovens with Q-tips. I remember sitting in a bathtub, naked, smoking crack. Yeah, with the curtain closed. Yeah, just... Yeah, one man freak show. And, you know, but I remember when I was wearing the wetsuit, because the wetsuit kept the bugs off of me. And it works, by the way. And then I wore a World War II leather flying helmet, like the kamikaze pilots wore, you know, with the donut ears, and that kept them off my head. But I remember looking in the mirror, and I could see my ribs through the wetsuit. And I thought I was cut, you know. I didn't realize that 140 pounds was sick. And it got worse, and it got darker, and I picked up the heroin again. And, you know, it was all about better living through chemistry, you know. Trying to find that place. Remember that place where if you do the right mixture, you'll get there? But if you're like me, I always missed it, and then I'd have to do something to bring myself back to that place, and then I miss it again, and back and forth, and, you know, and I could never get to that place. And then I started going to treatment centers, and I wouldn't last more than a couple of days, because, I had memories of being dope sick. And I refused to detox. One time I got shot up with Narcan. And if you've ever had a Narcan experience, anybody had a Narcan experience? It sucks. I was pissed. You know, I didn't know I was dying. You know, and then I didn't know I was overdosing. And then they shot me up with Narcan. They ruined my high, as far as I was concerned. And they put me right into detox, and so I didn't last in that treatment. They used Narcan for detoxing. They didn't have the Suboxone back then. They did methadone detox and I forget the name of the drug. It's used for blood pressure. Clonidine. Yeah, that's worthless shit. Then 2 days ago, 33 years ago. Oh, backing up real quick. There was a buddy of mine, Steve. And we had gone to college together. We had worked in the film industry together. We were really close. And he had a heroin. He was the guy who, in the beginning of my story, I told about, he was on the bed and I was on the couch. And the thought crime was committed and would go downtown. That was Steve. Well, Steve had called me in March of 85 and said, "Hey, Doug, I'm clean." I go, "Clean of what?" And he goes, I don't do heroin." I go, "Great, let's get together. We can smoke a doob." And he goes, "No, I don't do that." And, you know, and he was following the dead around. He had hair down to here. And, you know, pot was just, I mean, God gave us pot, right? It wasn't a problem with pot. You don't call it pot anymore, do you? Weed, marijuana, grass.
Mary Jane.
Mary Jane? Yeah, that's a name from the past. skunk weed. Yeah, whatever. But I said, "That's ridiculous. Why wouldn't you be smoking pot?" He goes, "No, I'm clean, and I'd like to take you to a meeting." Now, my only exposure to meetings at that time was an old cop show called Hill Street Blues. Captain Farillo on Hill Street Blues was an alcoholic, and they had AA meetings on TV. And it was the first time that I saw, because I had this thing where I thought that alcoholics were bums on the street who shat their pants and, you know, babbled incoherently. That was an alcoholic. But on this TV show, they looked like us. They looked like normal people. And I was like, And then I logged that in my memory banks. So when Steve said, "I want to take you to a meeting," and he said, "It's an NA," I was like, "Okay, I'll go." And, you know, I didn't do any dope that night. I just, I think I drank some whiskey and did some cocaine. Because I didn't really connect the dots. And after a few meetings, he said, "Doug, you're not getting it, dude. You don't get it. It's about being clean off of all mood-altering substances." And I was like, "Why?" I didn't get that. He said, "Just, you know, I can't hang around with you anymore." So roll the clock up to October 10th, 2 days ago, 33 years ago. I'm on the streets doing anything I can. I've stopped landing on my feet. I got nothing. Everybody in my family's been told, "Don't give Doug money." Unemployed, unemployable. I'm just a common bad thief. I wasn't even a good thief. And I suffer from IGS, which stands for imaginary gangster syndrome. So I wasn't even good at any of that. I'm a suburban white kid trying to make it in the jungle of New York. And, you know, and Steve called my mom, and my parents at this time were done with me. They had finally gone to Al-Anon and quit enabling me. And she said, "Where's Doug?" And she said, "I don't know, but he's supposed to check into treatment. And if you see Doug, tell him a message for us." And she said, "Tell him he's no longer our son. Tell him he's no longer part of our family. Tell him that there's nothing left for him here." And Steve found me. And Lower East Side of New York. You know, junkies are like magnets. And he wasn't really there to save me. He was there because he was on the run. But he saved me. He said, "I'm going to take you to Beth Israel Hospital." And I said, "I don't know. I need a bag of dope." And he bought me a bag of dope. He asked me to tie him off, and he took a shot. And then we got in his car. He had an old station wagon. And we drove to Beth Israel, and before I got out of the car, he had me tie him off one more time. Now, this is the guy who took me to meetings. And he looked at me and tears were running down his cheek. And he said, I hope it works for you. And I left and I walked into the lobby of this hospital. It was 11 o'clock at night by this time. And the guard said, can I help you? And I said, I'm going upstairs to the treatment center on the fourth floor. And he said, it's too late. Come back tomorrow. Now, do you remember the times when you almost got sober and you didn't? And it was like, phew, almost got sober. Glad I dodged that one. I had a few of those, but not this time. Because when I turned around to leave, I knew that I was walking into my coffin. I was 123 pounds. My liver was failing. My kidney was failing. I didn't have, I hadn't bathed in a month. I had a big bushy beard with dried blood, dried mucus in it. I was not very pretty. And I heard the voice of God. And it was the guard. And he said, you're here. Come in. Go on up. Now, on other times, I might have just kept walking. I tried. It didn't work. Not this time. I felt like the hand, an invisible hand, came, pulled me in, and brought me upstairs. And when I woke up yesterday, 33 years ago, I didn't wake up. I never went to sleep. But when I sort of was aware it was morning, there was this nurse, and I'm sure she was beautiful, and she could have been. She may not have been, but she was beautiful to me. And she had a sponge, and she was just real gently just wiping my face and looked at me, and she smiled without judgment and said, it's going to be okay, baby. It's going to be okay. And that was my first glimmer of hope. But it faded. It left. And then the thoughts. Remember the thoughts? That they start attacking you, that all your life, all the mistakes. Fuck this, it's not going to work. I don't know if I want to be sober. You know, what was I thinking? All that stuff. And on the third morning, I did wake up on the third morning. It was fourth floor, and it was overlooking a little park. And it was the middle of October. And the leaves on the trees were changing, and they started to become gold and yellow and red, and they were beautiful. And I realized I hadn't seen color in a long time. And that was a moment of hope. And I stayed. And, you know, after a few weeks, maybe 3 weeks, they said, you know, you got nothing here. Your parents don't want you. Your sister doesn't want you. You're unemployable. You owe people money. You got nothing in New York. You need to leave. And when you do, you need to go to Minneapolis or Phoenix. So it was the end of October, so I looked at the New York Times weather section. Minneapolis was about, I don't know, 80 below. And Phoenix was 80 degrees and sunny. I didn't know about the summers. And so I came out to Phoenix and started my life here. And that was 33 years ago. And, you know, I hadn't been laid in a really long time, so that was first order of business. because the first part of your body that wakes up when you get sober is your genitals. And I heard somebody say that back then in the AA meetings, they used to say, don't get into a relationship in your first year. And it sounded like Charlie Brown's mom to me. But I did hear a relationship, so I got into seven, because I like to follow direction. But the thing is that I would go where the halfway house bus went, and I went to Cocaine Anonymous. And that's where I hung my hat. And Cocaine Anonymous was much like HA in its early days, and we built Cocaine Anonymous. And over the last 14, 15 years now, I think it is, we've built Heroin Anonymous. And, you know, my recovery, my sobriety has been difficult at times, real difficult at times. There have been bankruptcies and death. I've been married twice. Thank God for my wife today of 24 years. You know, I have a son who's going to be 31. I have two grandsons. I own a home. I own a business. I write paychecks instead of forging checks. You know? And the formula for me was really simple. You know? See, what I've discovered is the magic. You know, people talk about the steps, and the steps are the stairway to growth. But to me, the secret sauce is the connection between me and you. That's the secret sauce. And there's a little quick little story about that. Bill Wilson, the guy who founded Alcoholics Anonymous, before AA started, he came out to Akron, Ohio to cure his financial ills because him and his wife were suffering financially terribly. And it was all hinged on a good deal that he knew he was going to get. And he was sober about 6 months. And he had failed miserably trying to preach to other drunks. Well, the deal fell through. He didn't get his way. And he knew he had one of two choices. He'd go to the bar in the hotel because he heard the clinking of the glasses, saw the smoke rising and the music playing, and it was pulling him like a magnet. But then the thought occurred to him, what I need to do is I need to find me a drunk to talk to. Not a drunk to help, not a drunk to save. I need to find me a drunk to talk to. And he started making phone calls. And back then, it wasn't even a pay phone. It took nickels. And he finally got a hold of this lady who said, yeah, I know a drunk doctor named Dr. Bob Smith. And Smith gave him 15 minutes. 5 hours later, Smith found new hope. And Bill Wilson didn't drink that day. So the secret sauce is talking to another addict, making that connection. You know, addiction is the disease of loneliness. It's the disease of disconnection. And what we do here is, you know, when you're new and we say get a service commitment, that's the secret sauce. We're pulling you in, making you part of the team. You know, when we tell you to call us every day, we really don't want to hear from you every day. You ain't got shit to say, believe me. But what happens is that it helps to form habits so that when you get into that place that Bill was in, you make the call. You know, and I'll share with you, I'm running out of time, so I'll share with you a story about the secret sauce. And you see, Heroin Anonymous is heaven. And I actually have proof. You see, there was this guy, and he wanted to know what heaven and hell were like before he continued on in his life. So he went to the tour guide, Heaven and Hell Tours, and the tour guide said, all right, I'll take you down to hell, and then I'll take you to heaven. So they went to hell, and what hell looked like was this. It was a room the size of a football stadium, massive. And inside this room, the floors were all made of Italian white marble, beautiful. And the walls were hand-carved oak. And all the windows had silken drapes, beautiful. In the middle of the floor was this gigantic, gigantic Persian rug. And on top of the Persian rug was a hand-carved table. Beautiful table. On top of the table was all of the finest foods you could ever imagine. And it smelled wonderful, and it looked wonderful, and it tasted wonderful. And yet all the people sitting around the table, and there was probably 2,000 people, they all looked sick and gaunt and like they hadn't eaten. And he looks at him and he thought, well, that's strange. So then he goes to heaven. And in heaven, he sees the exact same scene. He sees this gigantic room the size of a football stadium. Huge. Italian marble floors and the hand-carved walls with the silken drapes. The beautiful Persian rug in the middle, massive, the size of a football field. Huge table with thousands of people sitting around eating the most delectable foods and desserts and vegetables and fruits and cheeses and beef and chicken and fish and vegetables and just the smells and the delicious. And yet all the people, the thousands of people sitting around the table, were laughing and they had pink cheeks and they were fed and they were having a great time. And the guy said, I don't get it. Why? What's the difference? And the tour guide looked up at him and he said, you may have noticed in both places they have 4-foot-long forks and 4-foot-long knives and they're tied to their arms. And it's impossible to feed yourself with 4-foot-long forks and knives. You just can't do it. So what they do in heaven is they pick up their food and they feed their brother and they feed their sister. And that's what heaven is. And that's what Heroin Anonymous is that you come in here and I feed you, and you feed him, and he feeds her, and she feeds him. And that's how it works. And it doesn't diminish. Every time somebody is fed, the light gets brighter and brighter and brighter. So Heroin Anonymous is heaven, and I'm glad to be here. I really am. And I'm really excited to come up and share my birthday with you. It's been just a real gas. And I love you, and I'll pass.